Hey folks, I'm Simon Ward, your host for this weekly podcast. Over the years, I've come to realise that achieving one's goals as a triathlete is not possible unless you support this with good nutrition, excellent recovery, develop a robust framework through mobility and strength training, and have a happy, balanced work and family life. Each of these elements contributes to our race day performances and gives us the best chance of turning those dreams into reality. Each week, my goal is to introduce you to the experts and thought leaders in each of these fields to help you squeeze the most from your life and enjoy racing success. So, without further ado, let's crack on with this week's guest. Hello, everybody. Well, today I'm welcoming him back. He's a friend of mine. We've done a lot of stuff together. He's been on a couple of podcasts, although you've not been on for a while. So, welcome, Mr. Graham Brookhouse.
Hi, Simon.
How are you doing today?
I'm really good, really cold because I still haven't put the heating on in the house for the winter yet, but there we go. It's a cottage and that's what you do down in the depths of Gloucestershire.
Yeah, well, so I'm up in Yorkshire at the moment, Graham, and actually it's dry today. We had 24 hours of solid rain.
I heard about that.
Yeah, as I live on the marina, I was expecting an arc to come rolling in and sort of pairs of animals to come wandering down looking for a refuge.
Yeah, that would be good, quite funny, knocking on your door.
Yeah. Anyway, Graham, look, you're always good value. You've got a lot of coaching experience and you've always got some nice insights into how people can improve their performance, both from a coaching perspective. You're a swim coach mostly, but people who don't know you should know that you're an Olympic medalist, bronze medal in the modern pentathlon team event. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes, back in 1988.
Oh, and the dog as well. Did that get a medal?
That's Isabel.
Isabel. And so you're a swim coach mostly now?
Yeah, I don't really do a lot of it. I used to coach a swimming club per se, so it was like mainly teenagers. So I had the likes of Vicky Holland when she was a teenager, and also Jamie Cook, who's a current world champion in pentathlon. Mm. It came through, if you like, the system down this way. Now I just sort of, I pretty much just help triathletes, help them on their, you know, on their journey, and give them the, you know, the wisdom or any knowledge that I have that they care to listen to.
You're not a bad triathlete yourself, though, are you? You've been to Kona. You and I raced on that course in the same year, 2017.
Yes. So I only been to Kona once, but I've been doing triathlon on and off for the last, I suppose, about 25 years, really. I just enjoy doing it. I see it as a nice lifestyle and a healthy one to follow, really. And as a result of that, you know, you just do your best. But I have to keep remind myself and a lot of other people, it is our hobby and we're not professionals, and we have to fit it in with our lifestyles.
But you're the same age as me, aren't you, Graham?
Born 62, is that right?
No, you're a couple of years older than me. Then I'm 56 next birthday in February.
Oh, yeah. So I'm born 62, so that makes me older than you. I can't remember how old.
Yeah, 58 next year maybe for you.
Probably, yeah.
But,
yeah, 58 next year.
So you're still doing triathlon, and I mean, you are being a little bit, showing a little bit of humility there, because you're a regular top five finisher in Ironman events, aren't you, in your age group?
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I suppose that's not really obviously why I do them, to get on the podium, but I am noticing as you move through the 50s age group how every year seems to be like really important. There's guys coming into the 55 plus age group on a world stage and they're running just over 3 hours off the bike, which I just find insane.
Yeah, we have to be careful who some of them are though.
Yes.
podium places and age group winners in Kona are getting a few boos now because of their previous history. So
yes, I have noticed that none more so than this year, I think, in the 70.3 worlds and the Kona worlds. There's a few names on the podium, which I suppose the diplomatic way of saying it would be
raise a few eyebrows.
Yes. Yes, depends where you sit, etc. But as far as I'm concerned, I don't really care, because most of us, most of us are doing it for our own, personal performance, and seeing if we can just do it better and be a better person along the way. So, you know, other people, that's their choice, isn't it, really?
Well, it is, and that's exactly what we're going to try and do today, Graham. As you know, you're a member of my Facebook page, the Triathlon Coach Cafe, and we get an influx of new members every month, and when they join, we ask them some questions about their triathlon journey and what their goals are. We also ask them to ask me a question that they would like answering. So you and I are going to try and get through some of those today. There's some questions from some beginners. There are questions from a whole range of athletes. I've separated out of a huge number that I get actually each month, I've separated them out into some that cover swimming, biking and running.
Yeah.
General training load, strength training. A couple of people have asked some quite interesting questions about our own reflections on coaching. We've got one from one of our older athletes, even older than you and I. So we can give him some salient advice and some other stuff. So let's crack on, Graham. We'll start off with your, if this was Mastermind, your chosen subject, which is swimming. So thank you. And I'll give a shout out to the people who've asked the questions. So Susan Fairfax asked, without a swim background, is it possible to increase my swim speed to be at the front of the pack? Now, I'm not sure what age group Susan is in, but Graham, you and I both tend to inhabit the front of the age group. You much further up than me. You're normally out first, and I'm usually out in the top 5 or 10 in my age group. So a place I'm sure a lot of people would swap for. And you've got a swim background. When did you start swimming?
About 3-4 years of age.
Yeah, you see, I didn't start. I could swim when I was that young, but I didn't really start doing any serious training until I was in my early 20s. But yeah. But bearing in mind the people that you've coached and where those people are now and your own experiences, how far do you think somebody could get without that childhood background in swimming?
I think a lot of it depends on that person's athletic ability coming into triathlon or into swimming. I've seen some people that don't appear to have any swim background at all, and it's quite possible for them to become very competent swimmers. But I've also seen people that come from an athletic background and they just plateau and never seem to get quicker at all. So it's like all of these questions, the first answer always seems to be it depends, which we know is the stock. Well, it depends.
Yeah.
And I guess it depends on what Susan exactly is asking, you know, what distances are we looking at? Because I think if you come from a swimming background then and you come into triathlon via the sprint and Olympic distance angle, the swimming is more important because of the proportion of the overall race that it takes. But when you're moving up to 70.3 and iron distance races, then the swimming is less important, I think. But obviously, at pro standard, it's now becoming even more and more important. It's, you know, you can't be a poor swimmer and hope to be right at the front end of the race. But I think certainly in age group terms, it's still possible. As a general rule, it is possible to, with the right coaching and the right practices, it's possible to increase your speed for swimming and be, I guess, what Susan would say, at the front of the pack.
Yeah, I always think that swimming, probably more so than cycling and probably a bit more so than running, is a process based on technique rather than fitness. I mean, you were talking about people with good athletic skills, perhaps as runners and cyclists, who never make it much progress in swimming. So they've clearly got the aerobic engine, but they just don't have the technical skills that allow them, allow them to swim effectively and efficiently. Equally, we both know people who come from a swimming background who are large units. They can come to the pool at our age, having not swum for 20 years, but because they've got those technical skills ingrained, you know, they're overweight, they're carrying a bit of fat, they haven't swum for years, and yet they would still probably go in the fast lane at the back.
Yes.
And just look fairly graceful in the water. So for me, there's got to be a willingness to devote a lot of attention to the process and the technique of swimming better, of being comfortable in the water, of getting the balance, of getting the feel, rather than just ploughing up and down, getting out of breath.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, is the willingness to spend time increasing that skill aspect of it. And that can happen. Depends on the individual self-realization of how skillful a discipline swimming is. Most people can bike to a certain extent because it's very much, you're clipped into your pedals. There's a bottom bracket. You've got two crank arms, and that sorts out the timing of one leg to the other leg. You don't really have a choice. But swimming, you've got to apply a force with one arm and the other arm, but then you've got to sort out the relationship between the right side and the left side. And I've found that a lot of swimmers that I've helped can actually exhibit quite a high level of skill doing sort of single arm type drills. But the problem occurs when they start to look at the relationship between the two.
Yeah. And also how the legs fit into that, of course.
But, yes.
For me, a willingness to devote on a regular basis and probably over several years, not several months, time to developing those skills and that timing and that patterning, because water's an alien environment for us humans, which is why elite swimmers need to spend so much time in the water each week for an event that lasts maybe 1 or 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And I also think that it's important to have regular input from a coach who can actually see what you're doing, because you've surely experienced what I have, in that you can tell somebody, this is what I'm observing your right arm doing. And they'll argue till they're blue in the face. No, it does this. No, actually, look, here's the video evidence. This is what's actually happening. So, which clearly demonstrates that it's impossible really to assess what you're doing while you're in the pool. You need somebody with skillful eyes to see that, identify what your flaws are, and then give you the right drills to correct those.
Yeah, that's I think a critical point, which in my experience, too many swimming teachers stroke coaches are very good at doing a video self-critique sort of analysis of the swimmer they're looking at, but actually I've come to the conclusion now that to change the behavior of the swimmer, it's all about what they need to go away and practice. To make those skill changes.
Yeah.
Just, there's too much of assumption put on that. Well, if I tell you your hand's entering in the wrong place, you will just change it. Well, actually, a lot of them can't do that.
No.
You've got to, what do I need to go away and practice so that I become more efficient and skillful?
So there is one of the issues, I think, with swimming in a group, is that coaches will give you a drill like, oh, this is a catch-up drill, this will help you catch, this is a doggy paddle, this will help. But actually, that might not be the drill that person needs.
No.
Coaches need to have a toolbox of drills, and for a specific issue that they see with an individual, they may need to do more of that particular drill. But somebody else might not need to do that. They might need another drill. They might need a timing drill rather than a positional drill.
Yes, exactly. And that's what really separates the good coaches from the less what I might say qualified coaches.
Yeah. There's one other thing that I would add to this as well, Graham, and for Susan, is and maybe for our next questioner as well, is one of the limiting factors I also see, and I've experienced this myself, is that you may have an understanding of what's needed. So, for instance, you may understand that you need to get a better cat, and it may be only on the left side that your arm's letting you down. The right side catch might be fine. But you might find that the reason that catch is failing and you're dropping your elbow has nothing at all to do with your positional awareness within the water or your ability to get into that position, but some sort of structural weakness in the shoulder due to a previous injury that then when the arm is faced with the resistance of water, it has to give way because it doesn't have the strength to overcome it. And so you lose your technique. So sometimes there may be a willingness from an athlete to go away and practice those drills, but an inability to develop it in the long term due to a physical weakness. And sometimes I think then we need to get out of the water and go and have an assessment with a physio to see whether there might be something else that's holding one back.
Which I think will be an underlying theme for today's questions, that part of the answer is always going to go back to you need that platform of strength and conditioning to either prevent injury or to rehab the injury, or to certainly build that platform so that you can perform these movement patterns in an efficient manner.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up, Graham, and it was something we were chatting about before the call is that all of this stuff, all of these, or a lot of these questions we're being asked today are about developing fitness and getting faster, swim, bike and run, and getting stronger. But you and I both understand and believe that there's a bigger platform below that, which is based around mobility, strength, lifestyle, nutrition, recovery, which supports your ability to be able to move forward in your fitness.
Yeah, because if one of those breaks down, you just can't do the training, can you? You're either too tired or you're injured or you don't have the energy, and you know, and that's it. I think it's part of life, isn't it? When you're younger, you just think you're, you know, nothing's going to happen to you. You're never going to get injured. You're never going to get ill, and you can do what you like, which to a certain extent seems to happen. And there's almost like anecdotal evidence that says that is correct, but actually you probably are doing damage. And it's only when you get older, you appreciate more of that platform is necessary to actually prevent those things from being negative.
That's why we have two old heads presenting this podcast today, Graham. I've just worked out that our combined age is well over 110. You realise that?
Oh, that's good.
What a maybe depressing thought.
We should recruit another couple of athletes, and we could do the sort of like they do in the Masters swimming, the 200 plus years relay.
Yeah. Fortunately, our coaching experience is... probably goes over 50 years of coaching experience between us. And I think that's probably the more credible thing.
Yes, no, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So Susan, the answer to your question, I think, and Graham, you jump in at the end and correct me if I'm wrong. But Susan, I think number one, there has to be a willingness to invest time over a long period to keep getting better. And that much of that time has to be focused on developing the technical skills and timing in the water to support faster swimming. That doesn't mean that there isn't a place for faster swimming, but the majority of it's got to be around those technical skills. And bearing in mind that cardiovascularly, you're pretty well covered anyway with the cycling and the running that you do. So you don't need to develop that oxygen transport system as much in the pool.
Yeah.
There is time when you need to learn to swim fast, and having a good technique also means that it's robust enough to stay in place once you start swimming fast and getting tired.
Yeah. I mean, I would summarize that also in keeping it simple. I would always say learn how to paddle with one arm and the other arm, and then just learn how to time the relationship between the one paddling arm with the other paddling arm. And it is that simple. Mm-hmm. It can be over complicated so many times, you know, but that's all it is. You know, Newton actually probably would have been a really good swimming teacher, because if you apply a force in one direction, you'll move in the opposite and equal direction with that amount of force. And it is that simple, but it gets complicated.
I mean, it can be complicated by a coach who's trying to prove that they're worth by making everything seem really complex. But I would still go back to what I said before, that having a coach that you can trust and that you get on with, who can give you the right sort of advice on a regular basis, is also important. I don't think it's possible to become a better swimmer without an external observer.
No, exactly. And I think a lot better value than buying a set of race wheels for £2,000, which might improve you by maybe a minute and a half over 40K.
Yeah, yeah. And all of this, again, one of those underlying principles that we'll perhaps come back to in answering future questions, Graham, is a lot of it is about the process rather than the outcome. So the outcome of this is that you may swim more comfortably and faster, but it's about willing to engage in the process. and mastering those skills. Definitely. So, and you know, our next question, which comes from James West, is how can I get faster at swimming? No matter how hard I try, I feel I've reached my limit with swimming. So everything that we've just said, it seems to me that we would apply that first is go back to basics.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
Look at your technique. Look at how you are in the water. Have you engaged in the process? Are you just going to a group and swimming hard, or are you actually making progress with the process?
But on that, so I did a little exercise. I think I mentioned it to you 6 or 7 months ago, that swimming speed equals your stroke rate times your distance per stroke.
Yep.
So your distance per stroke, how far you travel every time you put your arm in the water, how far you travel forwards, that's very similar to what gear you are in on the bike, and then it's your stroke rate. Well, that combination equals speed.
Yep.
What a lot of people don't necessarily realize is that in order to say just go 5 seconds quicker per 100, which a lot of people will be very grateful for, it doesn't take a massive change in either of those two metrics. So if you just kept your distance per stroke exactly the same, but increase your stroke rate per minute by an extra 3 strokes per minute, you'd be surprised at how much faster you can go. So some people, without even changing their technical ability in you know, what gear they're in, just move your arms a bit quicker and you'll go a bit faster.
So well, and conversely, as you extend the distance, and going back to what we mentioned about structural, you know, biomechanics, strength around the joints, if you keep your stroke rate, but the distance per stroke falls, you're going to be slowing down. And in longer events, it's not about generally about how fast you go. It's about how little you slow down.
Yes.
So not just improving one of those parameters, but also doing what you can to stop them declining will also help you to maintain the speed.
Yes, yeah? Exactly. And I think sometimes, and just go, and it comes back to, I've always, well, I know people that try and go as hard as they can swimming, they will just plateau. You know, it's almost counterintuitive when you swim. In order to go faster, go slower.
Yeah. So again, maybe this is another common theme, is there's an awful lot of belief which is promoted by magazines and books in order to sell more, that, you know, you need to go harder. If you're training hard in training, then that's automatically going to lead to results and that you're going faster. But as we know, and a lot of people write in, it's not happening like that. It's almost this no pain, no gain that Brad Cairns talks about. Yeah. It's not really working. So as Graham says, go slower. You'll be surprised when you slow down that you actually don't, your times don't seem to drop that much, as in that your times don't seem to get worse.
Yeah, I mean, this time of the year, I would say anybody going out, I know it's an answer to running, but there's a lot of people in the group that have been exposed to the Phil Maffetone methodology to training. But wow, isn't it the best time of the year? Go out running and just look at the leaves on the trees. Mm. You know, never forget that we're blessed with this wonderful countryside where we can train. Just remember to actually spend time looking at the leaves on the trees. I mean, I competed in the Mont Blanc triathlon about 3 years ago, and I finished the race, and I said to a few people, I said, did you just see when we rode up that one hill, you could see the peak of Mont Blanc? And they looked at me as if I was like, stupid. No, I didn't see that. I said, well, why is it called the Mont Blanc Triathlon? And you just missed out on a wonderful opportunity to look at the views. You know, that's why we're doing it.
Well, just giving another podcast a plug here, another one of my podcasts I did with Malcolm Brown, maybe 2 years ago. Yeah. Malcolm was the run coach of the Brownies, and Vicky Holland that you mentioned earlier, and George Taylor Brown, many others. But when we were talking about how to become a faster runner, he said, you need to enjoy the process first, that process of running through the woods, listening to the twigs and the branches and the leaves crackle under your feet, enjoying the birds sort of twittering away.
What, rather than staring at your Garmin?
Yeah, who would have thought that would be an answer?
Yeah.
So are we agreeing here then that in order for James to get faster at swimming, what we're not going to do, we're not going to give him some amazing threshold sets to swim. We're going to suggest that he goes back to basics, has his stroke analysed, finds out what is where he's creating drag. You know, if his right arm's coming out too wide, it's likely that that's being countered by his left leg, which is creating drag. So he's slowing himself down. Can he become more efficient? Can he invest time in the technique?
And I also feel there's, when you've come from a swimming background, you've been brought up on on the bread and butter of interval training.
Yep.
But let's remember that the only reason that a lot of the pool-based swimming training is interval-based purely to relieve the monotony of that of those training sets. But they're also still a lot. Most of the training sets will be very aerobic training sets.
Yeah.
Well, which is great. If you're lake swimming, you might just do, you know, like three laps of a 1200 meter swim course, and that's fine because it's just nice, easy, continuous swimming. But when you're in the pool and you have to make it interval training, it's very easy if you take too much rest in between the intervals that you end up swimming inefficiently and too hard, you know. But you can't say to somebody, right, we're going to do a 40-minute continuous swim in the pool, in a 25-minute pool, because it's just mind-numbingly boring.
Yeah.
So we have to make it intervals. But then you have to be you have to swim smarter by always making sure that you're swimming efficiently. But you can do an aerobic swim set and do, you know, rather than count them, you can just get in for 40 minutes and do 25-meter reps.
Yep.
But you only need 2 or 3 seconds at the end of each length. But you may well be able to swim all of those very efficiently.
Mm.
That's what I would do.
Good point. Okay. Right now, this is probably a quick one, Graham. Mark Stanton wants to know, how do I stop goggles fogging up?
It depends. But very much on what I do, I never have a problem with goggles fogging up because I always just keep a little bit of water in the goggles sloshing around as I swim. So that way, you know, there's always enough residual water in them that stops them fogging up. I know some people have used probably a very traditional way. They sort of like spit in them and use saliva. I'm not so sure that actually works. But there's also, I know there's a few products which I'm sure if you Googled it, anti-fog drops for your goggles. And I think there's also some swim makes of goggles which they claim to be anti-fog goggles.
Yeah, I've just learned over the years that eventually all goggles fog up.
Yeah.
You know, even if you get anti-fog goggles, that sort of whatever they've covered the inside of the lenses with tends to wear off once it's been exposed to chlorine over many years. I'm like you, I just get a drop of water in there and just be comfortable with the fact that it's moving around. It doesn't have to be a lot, does it? Just a couple of little drops, not so much that it's getting in your eyes and causing you to swim with your eyes closed.
Yeah.
Good luck finding the pair. Find a pair of goggles that fit you and fit your face. And a little bit of advice to those people who attempted to go onto the Ironman journey, onto the cafe page and ask which are the best goggles. You'll end up with 642 replies, each of which offers you a different bit of advice, and you'll be more confused than before you ask the question. So find a pair of goggles that fit you, or nearly all of them, I would say, all of them will do the job that they're supposed to, which is to enable you to see under the water. And try an anti-fog product if you like. Try putting a bit of saliva on your finger and rubbing it around. Try Graham's tip. When I go diving, one of the things that they do to offer to help you stop your dive mask fogging up is they used children's shampoo, so which tends to be a bit weaker than adults, and then they put it in a bucket and they only put a few drops. So it's got a very, very, very weak soapy solution. You just dump your goggles in there and take them out, and that seems to work. So there's another offer, option for you to try.
Good.
Okay, right, Graham, let's move on to bike training now. So Sam Harrison said, bike training sessions, I've only ever ridden distance at a pace that suits. I'd like to know how people mix up sessions in order to improve speed. So I guess that when he means speed, because there's several different definitions of speed.
Yeah.
We could take the pure speed is just how fast your limbs move, and speed is generally something you can't keep up for very long. So let's talk about pace or race velocity, because I guess that what we're all trying to do is go a little faster for a little longer.
We need to be.
Yeah. So in order to improve the miles per hour or kilometers per hour I can ride at, what sort of sessions do people do in order to enable us to improve? Graham, what do you do with your training? Because you're a pretty strong biker.
Through the winter, I do quite a lot of one of my like favorite bread and butter go-to sessions are minute intervals on the bike, either a watt bike or sometimes outside, but I actually prefer doing it on the turbo. So it's just a minute hard, so fairly strong, and then a minute easy spin. Mm-hmm. And through the winter, I might start with 12 reps and then add one rep every couple of weeks. So by the time you get to the end of February, you're up to doing sort of 25 to 30 reps, and it's just over an hour type session. Each minute is hard enough that you're sort of looking forward to the 60 seconds being over, but you quite easily do complete it. And you can also, depending on your boredom limits, you can change the cadence as you do that, and that tends to build a lot of strength. I sometimes might do a little pyramid of 4-4-4. So I might do 4 lots of 30 seconds, 4 lots of a minute, 4 lots of 30 seconds, and do each repetition leaving every 2 minutes, so easy spinning in between. And again, that's quite good, but it can be power based, it can be cadence based. I think anything that enables you to hit a higher power output than your normal race pace power output is going to help with building speed, because it's speed in certain terms. It's about muscle fiber recruitment, if you want to delve into that. So anything where you are putting more power into it, you're going to get an increased muscle fiber recruitment.
You mentioned in that previous question about swimming, about the two main components is stroke rate and distance per stroke. It's very similar in running, stride length and stride frequency.
Yeah.
In cycling, if you use the same gear, but you're able to pedal 1 RPM per minute faster, you will go further.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you can maintain that for 40 kilometers, or if you can maintain that for 90K or 180K, then you will be, I don't know what the figures are, because it depends on the gearing and the cadence and everything, but you will get faster. So I suppose, again, you would go back to the beginning and say, well, how much faster do you want to get? There seems to be a belief that people have to boost their winter power by an extra 30 watts, but in order to go faster, you only need to make small changes in a couple of parameters. Yeah, yep. Either you pedal the same cadence with a bigger gear and you go further, or you pedal the same gear and you go a little faster. The efforts that you mentioned there, the 30-second and the 60-second efforts, allow you to push significantly more power and probably significantly higher cadence, but only in short periods. What we want to do, we definitely don't want to go to that extreme. You wouldn't be pushing that power, that cadence for. You definitely wouldn't want to be trying to keep that cadence and that power over the duration of your Ironman or your standard distance triathlon. But in order to be able to support that sort of work that you've been talking about for the number of kilometers in a triathlon, there's also a significant amount of easy work that you need to do to just stimulate the aerobic enzymes and fibers. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's the other part of the winter training, which for you would be what?
I just ride my bike and keep it simple. Try and ride my bike 4 times a week, certainly before Christmas. I wouldn't really look to do any sessions above 2 hours at all. As long as I'm regularly and consistently getting on my bike, then I think that that forms the basis of your, it's almost like your, I know you put out the base winter plans. I'm sure that's very, very similar. I think when you want to, I mean, it comes back to what are you actually trying to target and what changes you want to elicit. I think sometimes it's very easy to ride your bike too easy, but it's also a lot of people probably will ride the bike too hard. So, you know, it comes back to a lot of people talk about sweet spot training, which is in my world, you know, I call that sort of tempo. It's that nice, it's that nice, comfortable, strong pace where you can have conversations, but you don't really want to be talking too long. I've actually found that type of training for me works considerably in bringing me on for long distance racing. You know, you become very efficient. It's probably a speed a lot quicker than Ironman pace. I think it's the bread and butter of doing an Ironman distance race on the bike leg. You have to do those sessions.
Yeah, I like to include those sessions a bit closer to my race. So they're probably in the 10 weeks before an event.
Yeah, I agree.
I'll be doing, and I think Dan Plew's talked about this a lot. We could reference some of the stuff he did when he trained up to become the fastest age grouper ever in Kona. Yeah. But he was doing four lots of 30 minutes at a power that was maybe 10 to 20 watts above what he'd be expecting in an Ironman. So actually, on its own, that session isn't particularly debilitating. You know, or 30-minute effort at 10 to 20 watts above an Ironman pace wouldn't be particularly debilitating for a well-conditioned athlete. A set of four reps like that, you would leave the session feeling reasonably fatigued, but you'd probably recover quite quickly.
Yeah.
If you're training for a standard distance race, then you're probably going to be working harder than that, and so your peak period might be more work at threshold. So what Stephen Sealer seems to think that from his research, that 4 times 8 minutes at somewhere around threshold, a bit above, just a bit below, you know, vary it, you're going to be in the right ballpark. But still, for the majority of winter, that polarized approach, riding many miles at around sort of 65 to 70% intensity, gives you all of the aerobic developments you need, and doing those intervals that you talked about, the 60-second efforts, what we call high intensity interval training, as in last week's the week before last podcast with Paul Larson, that's the sort of work that we're talking there to improve your VO2 max, your power output, etc.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so Sam, hope you get what you like out of that one. A lot of low level work to build endurance. Some maybe 10%, 20% of your weekly work at that much higher intensity.
I suppose it is. It's probably a good idea just to mention, because it does talk about how do I improve my speed through training. There are going to be those people that have time trial bikes that are going to do the triathlon. So, you know, the ability to ride in an aerodynamic position, we know, is going to make you quicker per se.
Yeah.
And I think you still, whether it's through the winter, I think sometimes you can't really do enough of it. You know, practice riding in that position. You know, I've seen too many people go to a wind tunnel or go for a bike fit, et cetera, and they, yes, they can demonstrate being in an aerodynamic position, but then they can't actually hold that position for the race because it's not trained.
So I did a podcast with Louisa, the physio that you and I have both seen in
The White Witch.
The White Witch, yes. Yeah. The first podcast was about the assessment that she does to look at the way the whole body functions really and works. And you and I have both been through that, Graham. But then the second, and that was with a view to doing a bike fit rather than a run assessment. But the second part of the second podcast to follow on from there was once you've got all of these bits of feedback from her about whether your shoulders are tight, whether you're how strong your glutes are, what your calves are like, is how do you put that into practice? What do you do on a regular basis to ensure that things get better and you can maintain that position that you're speaking about there for the number of minutes or hours required in your race. And I think there's a misunderstanding that in order for a ride to be to have any validity, let's say you're training for a half Ironman, in order for that ride to be any validity, riding in the aero position, you have to be riding hard. You can actually get on your bike and go for a really easy ride, but stay in the aero position for 2 hours, and you will gain benefit from that in terms of being comfortable in that position for 2 hours. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. I think that's important.
Great. Well, look, the next question then from Scott Pearson. Scott comes from a running background and wants to compete and wants to know whether it's more important for him to focus on cycling or swimming. Can we decide whether one's more important for than the other, for starters?
No, I think I think that draws us to the statement that triathlon is three events, and you have to be fairly competent at all three of them to actually complete them, to complete the event in the first place, and one leads into the next. You need to be a competent swimmer so that you can get on your bike and still have, you know, enough energy to then complete the cycling section. But then likewise, you need to be a competent cyclist to then be able to run. Because I think, wasn't there a study where they took some Kenyan runners?
Yeah.
And basically, as they weren't bike trained, when they came to the run section, they just all became sort of like novice runners in relevant terms.
Yep.
You'll probably remember that more than I would.
I can't remember the study, but I do remember, and I'm not sure if it was an educational type of research, or whether it was just an experiment to see whether those guys would still be able to outrun the field, and they couldn't. For me, if you want to compete, you've got to be efficient in the swim. If you are floundering around and using huge amounts of energy to get through the swim, even in a wetsuit, you definitely aren't going to have as much energy to put in the bike. And if you're not well trained on the bike, as you've described with those Kenyan runners, you're definitely not going to get the benefit out of all of that running fitness. So even if you can't become a fast swimmer, again, and going back to what we discussed right at the beginning, try to become an efficient swimmer so you get through the swim having used the minimum amount of energy necessary to swim that distance. And then on the bike, there's no reason why somebody from a run background can't develop good bike fitness. You know, a lot of the Talent ID programs for the Olympic triathletes focus around being good swimmers and runners, and if you have the engine and the skills to be good at those two, you can easily develop the skills to become a stronger biker. So my answer to you there, Scott, is neither is more important. You need to spend equal time developing your swimming and your cycling, but with a running background, it probably means that you'll be able to maintain that running fitness with probably one or two runs each week. You definitely don't need to do as much running because you'll still be getting the aerobic fitness developments from the pull time and the bike time.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
Let's move on then, Graham. Let's talk about running. How to improve my run for full Ironman. It goes wrong at full distance, yet it's my strength for all other distances. So if I'm doing a half Ironman, if I'm doing standard, and my running is my background. So that sounds like sounds very similar to the one we've just answered from Scott. That question is from Sam Boswell.
Yeah, I think I know your thoughts and my thoughts probably are very similar. It's welcome to Ironman.
Well, welcome to our world as well. Our runs seem to go, events seem to go like that, don't they? Starts off great with the swim. You're in the lead.
Yeah.
You get overtaken by a few people, probably the younger kids on the bike, but you still maintain a decent position in your age group. And then on the run, you feel like you're stood on the treadmill while everybody else is shuffling past you.
Yeah, so there's nothing worse than having people run past you. And as they run past you, analyze their running style, and you think, I can't believe I've just been overtaken with somebody running like that.
Yeah.
But actually, you're probably running a lot worse than they are. But you just don't realize it.
Yeah.
So, yes, we know it's not unusual for running to go really pear-shaped in an iron distance race. But I think it's probably at least twofold, the supply of energy. So I think if you listen to one of Tim O'Donnell's comments on the UCAN podcast, he refers that the biggest change from stepping up to iron distance racing is you have to have your nutritional strategy nailed. Mm-hmm. And if it isn't, you effectively kiss goodbye to any sort of semblance of running well.
Yep.
My personal experience, I felt my best ever run in an iron distance race was what I felt was the hardest bike ride I've done in the iron distance race. So I started the run and I'd never felt so tired before the start of the run, but ended up running the best I've ever done. But I put that down to probably having the correct nutritional strategy on the bike. Mm. And if you do that and you've done the bike training, you will run okay. But we all know getting that nutritional strategy correct on the bike is the holy grail, isn't it? And
You said you got a twofold approach, Graham. So nutrition was one. What was the other one?
Well, the other is being a strong enough biker that you've still got some legs left to do the run.
Yeah. Okay. So I agree with both of those. I'm going to add another little bit of information to that. Often what we see is athletes who get through the first third of the run to the first half, and then they're running a time that's around their target time,
yeah,
for the whole marathon. But then it all starts to go pear shaped from that midpoint. And if you look at the splits, they may be a minute or more per kilometer slower in that second half. Now that could come down to nutrition as well. If you're feeling sick and nauseous from your nutrition, and you can't get any more in because you just can't swallow it, then you're running out of energy, and you're going to slow down. So that's maybe something to review and maybe listen to the podcast we did last week with UCAN. It may well be biomechanical. And this is something that I experienced, was that I could get to halfway and then it felt like my back got tighter, my hips got tighter. I just couldn't lift my feet up off the ground more than a centimeter. So I ended up in what they call the Ironman shuffle. And once I had my assessment with Louisa, it all became clear that I was actually tight in my upper back. Being in an aero position for a long while was contributing to that. I wasn't very mobile around my hips, and the way I ran put more emphasis on my hips. I wasn't very strong in the calves, and so I couldn't use the Achilles tendon and the bones and muscles in my foot to work like springs, and so you lose all that bounce, and everything just shut down. And so and my legs just felt so sore that I just was reduced to a walk and a shuffle. At that point, you can't really come back from there. And the answer for me has been to focus more on the biomechanics of running and doing a lot more running drills and focus on my daily mobility, which is important at my age anyway, to prevent injury, but also to ensure efficient running. And again, we come back to that word of efficiency, Graham. It's not about running fast. Long distance racing is about being efficient in all three disciplines.
And slowing down.
Yes, and that's right. So in the examples of those people just mentioned where they're on target for the first half, but then they slow down, they don't actually need to learn to get faster in training. They need to be able to preserve that pace they've got. And I think the key to that is not in doing more running and not in running faster. It is nutrition and biomechanics. And there is an element of mental strength in there, because an event like that is not going to be without its opportunities to give up and slow down or give up. And so you have to push through those. So there's got to be some mental toughness. But no amount of mental toughness will make up for poor skills and endurance.
Yeah, no, I agree. I quite like, and I mean, it probably brings you up onto the next question about improving running form and being able to complete higher intensity sessions without feeling discomfort in my lower legs. It's really. I mean, completing higher intensity sessions, well, I think everyone would probably feel discomfort in their lower legs if you're doing quite a high intensity running session. So I don't think there would be a solution to that. That goes with the territory, doesn't it, of higher intensity running?
Yeah, I mean, the body adapts to things. So if you do enough of them, your calf muscles will not hurt as much or for as long. But I would expect, particularly if you're running on the track, that there would always be some lower leg muscle tightness. That might be biomechanics, and therefore, again, you might want to get an assessment from physio to see whether actually those muscles are firing in the right pattern, and whether you're not, you know, it might be that if your calf muscles are getting tight, you might be overusing your calf muscles because your glutes aren't working properly.
Yeah.
So, you can't address that by doing more running. You've got to go backwards and do some sort of remedial work to address that.
Yeah.
If you don't do those sessions regularly and go back every 2 or 3 weeks, then your muscles have forgotten what they were doing, and so they're going to feel tight again. So you've got to do it regularly. And I would also ask, how much high intensity running do you want to do? So that question was from Mark Elston. Mark, how much high intensity running do you wish to do, and how much high intensity running is it necessary for you to do in order to be a better runner? Because as we've already discussed in relation to swimming and biking, it's not always the high intensity stuff that leads to the long-term improvements.
No. And I think, I'm quite a big advocate of doing hill running. I know you've used stadiums and going up steps in a stadium before.
Yep.
I quite like that because it seems to me, it improves the, if a vector like your contact point of the running, so that you know you're not sort of landing, collapsing through your heel. You can be a bit more bouncy because you have to be because you're going uphill. So not only is it building calf strength, but it's putting your foot in a position where it's probably quite good from a biomechanical point of view.
Chris Jones used to use hill strides and hill bounds a lot. Biomechanics as well, using your glutes properly. Going back to that calf strength though, Graham, and something that you and I both fell foul of when we saw Louisa was calf. We actually didn't really have much calf strength, did we?
No.
I think yours was, Louisa still talks about it as being one of the worst she ever saw.
Yes, I know. I think somebody's beaten it now, though, haven't they?
Yes, they have. Yes, somebody managed to do one calf raise.
Yeah.
Which lowered the bar significantly.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so again, Mark, running form, let's just talk a little bit about running form. Definitely some running drills. There's fast feet roll throughs. There are some running stride drills you can do. There's some specific gym exercise. I'm actually going to go to the running track soon with Louisa and video a whole series of drills which we can make available, but that'll be a few weeks. But that's something that's coming up, and then I'll be able to share those with you, Mark. So thank you for that question. Let's move on to some other stuff now, Graham. Stuart Logan asks us about overtraining syndrome, how to know when to ease off. So firstly, I'd just like to define or give my definition of overtraining versus under recovery.
Yeah.
Overtraining to me is when you constantly do too much for your body and you wear it down. So if you were to go on a training camp or you've got a week off and you put in a big volume of training that's abnormal, but then you do too much and you dig a big hole, what's more likely to affect the majority of listeners is what's called under recovery. And there is a subtle difference with under recovery. Under recovery is where you have your normal training load, but other stressors make that training load untenable. So let's say you do 10 hours a week. One week when you get plenty of sleep and you've got low stress, you can recover from it and you go along doing it 10 hours a week and it's okay. Then the next week you've got a big work deadline, or maybe you've got a family member who's ill in hospital and you need to do a bit more caring for them, or you know, you're just not sleeping well because it's too hot or because the neighbors are being noisy. So you're failing to recover properly from your normal training load and you start to get a bit run down. So there's a subtle difference. For me, being aware of exactly what's happening to your body, aware of why you're tired, understanding that above normal fatigue is not natural, and being willing to take your foot off the gas and ease back on your training are the keys to that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, so the specific question of how to know when to ease off, it starts with regularly listening to your body, isn't it? And not ignoring what your body is telling you. And I think the body's really clever. And if you're prepared to listen to what your body is telling you, it's very good at telling you the right things. And then go with your gut feeling. Like, you know, so if you're asking the question, should I have a day off today? You probably do need a day off today.
Well, and also what I'd say there is the key to being knowing when to ease off is actually not to get into that position in the first place, because if you're having to think about easing off, you're probably already descending down into that hole, and you probably need to take a bit longer off. Whereas if you build, and I think this is another thing, a lot of people say, well, I don't need a day off, but then they end up in a situation where they need to take a week off, or they end up having an enforced week off because they get an injury or an illness.
Yeah.
If you put in natural breaks where you have a day off each week, and you have a recovery week every 2 to 3, then you can sort of preempt all of this positioning, and you sort of don't need to be easing back quite as much. I think it's irrelevant as well to listen to and observe what the pros are doing. You know, you can see people like Joe Skipper, for instance, has raced Ironman Wales, raced in Kona, and then won Ironman Florida, all within the space of 2 months. But Joe's a pro athlete. He only has to cope with training and day-to-day admin. That's his full-time occupation. And also, he is a well-conditioned individual that's used to putting his body under that sort of pressure, so he will recover quicker. And people who end up at that level where they're finishing in the top 10 in the world championships just tend to be more robust individuals. It's sort of like a Darwinian type of survival of the fittest. So please don't be looking at other people and say, well, they never take time off. The key to avoiding this is take regular rest days, regular recovery weeks, listen to your body.
I know with some of your athletes, you use training peaks. And I know there is a metric on there, isn't there, that I haven't used it myself, but I don't know whether you've used that as a way of, is it called the fatigue index?
The TSB, they use it. It's basically if you do training, you accumulate points depending on duration and intensity of training. And it also measures fatigue, which is building up. And then there's a figure which is supposed to highlight the difference between the two. If you want to create adaptation, you need to be between a score of minus 10 and minus 30. The bigger the minus number, the deeper you're descending into a hole. You can go to minus 50 or 60 or 100 for short periods of time, but you probably don't want to stay in that place for very long. So if you went on a...
Have you found that's been quite a good reflection of the athletes that you've been training?
I have, and it's also a good thing to use to reflect upon and think, well, why am I in this particular number here? How long have I been here, and what should I be doing to help me come out of it? So I think you need to descend down to minus 30 or minus 40 and then have a bit of time with some easier training to allow yourself to come out of that and get back up to a zero or a plus number before you go back down again. And if you look at if you have access to look at the performance management chart, which I could maybe put a photograph of on the show notes with some illustrations, you can see how there are peaks and troughs in the training, but the trend is upwards, and that's supposed to indicate increasing fitness. But athletes were being successful. I mean, you made it to the Olympic podium, Graham, in 1988 before things like training peaks where heart rate monitors had only just started to gain in popularity. And there were athletes before you that became world record holders and Olympic medalists who had nothing to use other than what their body was telling them. So yeah. I still think that is if we're looking for the way forward, the best way is to listen to those signals. You know, if you're tired, if you're sore, if something hurts, there's a good reason.
It would be quite interesting if they ran a triathlon where nobody was allowed to wear any electronic device whatsoever. So imagine if Garmins and power meters were not allowed. I just think that would be fascinating to see what people's reaction to that would be.
Yeah, the naked triathlon. Yeah. We'd get spectators coming for all the wrong reasons.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Okay, so Stuart, I think the answer to your question there is overtraining system, overtraining syndrome. Use gadgets if you want. Garmin and Sunto and Polar probably have things now that tell you what recovery time. It's not a bragging thing to go, hey, look at that. After this bike ride, it says I need 72 hours recovery. Then laugh about it and say, but how am I going to do my training tomorrow? Sometimes there might be an element of truth in that. Listen to your body. And like Graham said, if you are thinking about taking a day off because you are losing motivation to train, you're probably best listening to that that signal. In fact, there's an awful lot of the world's best coaches and best recovery experts that think that motivation to train, your enthusiasm to get up early and go to the pool or go out running in the rain, indicates how recovered you are. If you're highly motivated and you get your kit on and go straight out the door, that usually means you're up for it and that's fine. If you sit around for another 10 minutes and have another cup of tea, you're probably best just continuing that behaviour and reading the paper as well.
I think that might be age related though as well. It certainly is for me.
All right, Graham, something we've both experienced here. Suzanne Gray said, what strength and conditioning training do you feel is key to improving performance and preventing injury? So shall we take a step back before strength and conditioning? What's the other thing that both you and I have learned to do in the last couple of years?
Sleep more.
Yeah, sleeping's good, but there's something else that Sarah's taught us. Sarah Pitts.
Oh, yes. just mobility, isn't it?
Let's hope she's not listening to this podcast, Graham.
That's true, yeah. So mobility and range of movement and just staying mobile and loose.
Yeah, so I've got a strength and conditioning background, and so I've always been into and understood the value of lifting weights and keeping a robust body. But what Sarah convinced me was that if you've got a muscle that's too tight, so if you can't put both arms straight above your head and clasping your biceps to your ears in the way a swimmer might streamline off the wall, if you can't do that, that might indicate that there's some tightness in your upper back, in your lats, in your shoulders. And Sarah's arguments, this is Sarah Pitts from Most Motion, and if you're on my SWAT group or my cafe page, you will see Sarah post regularly. Sarah would argue that until you have full range of motion in those muscle groups, there is absolutely no point in making them stronger because you won't be able to use that extra strength through its full range of motion. So, and you and I, Graham, I mean, you've competed at a high level, but your mobility is needed to be improved and has definitely improved since Sarah and Louisa got their hands on you.
Yeah. No, it's as you get older, I think it's critical. You know, you have to stay mobile so you keep that range of movement through those joints. and it's, you know, with people like Sarah out there, it doesn't have to be too difficult. You know, my gripe is always having somewhere like nice and warm to do it when you've finished a session. You know, if you just got off the watt bike and there's like a pool of sweat and you're drenched, you've got to almost like get fully showered and changed before you can do it. Mm-hmm. Or it's a dark winter night and you've come in from a run. So,
well, that doesn't matter so much. I mean, the body, the core temperature will probably, you know, if you've been at the track and you have to drive home and it's a half hour drive, you're probably going to stiffen up anyway sitting in the car. So you probably do want to do something to loosen when you get home. But if you put on some warm clothes and you turn the heating, not at full blast, but at least onto a comfortable level, your core temperature will stay warm enough to be able to get some value out of the mobility when you get home. But I agree, you know, it's unpleasant to think in a winter's day that you've come in from a run and you need to do half an hour stretching outside because that's just that's probably counterproductive.
Yeah.
But mobility first and then some basic strength exercises, I would think, some basic stability stuff for the shoulders, for the hips, definitely some calf raises. And There's an awful lot of small muscle group exercises, the muscles which provide stability, so which would help maintain the right technique like we're talking about with swimming earlier on.
Yeah.
And once you've got those cracked and you can do those on a regular basis, then I would think about lifting heavier. And so hopefully we're going to get full marks from Sarah when she listens to this, because we're now speaking her language.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Okay. Should we move on to the coaching ones?
Well, I was thinking we could do that one last, because there's a couple of other questions that I thought we could whistle through quite quickly, and we've probably covered those. So Stephen Parfitt said, tips for training when you're over 60. we haven't quite reached that level yet, so this is advice we'll be following.
The older you get, there seems to be, and the evidence is suggesting that we've got to keep up doing a certain amount of high intensity training, haven't we, as we get older? So I think, yes, you have to do that, but it comes back to the older you get, the longer it takes to recover. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it takes longer to get there. It's like, yes, it takes longer to get it, and it's quicker to lose it.
Yep. Oh, absolutely.
And if you don't use it, you tend to lose it. So it comes back to the old adage of you've got to just try and train consistently, haven't you, and cover all the bases. I don't think necessarily you have to do, I think just comes back to that our favorite word, consistency. Mm. You know, and I think too many people try and do it, you know, like hitting a target. It's sort of, it doesn't have to be always that specific, you know, like, you know, if the target is 240 watts, if you do the session at 225 watts, you know, it's not a complete waste of time. It's, you know, it's the shape of the icing might be slightly different, but in the overall scheme of things for that one particular session, it's not probably going to matter that much.
No, you know? I agree, Graham. I think, you know, firstly, Stephen, if you're over 60 and you're still enthusiastic to be thinking about training, congratulations, because you might look around amongst your triathlon friends and think you're not fit enough. But if you look around at the general population around you of your age, you are sat at the top of the tree there, and you're in a very elite group of people who are still actually able to think about doing a triathlon. You know,
well, there's a lot of people. I'll give you an example. My father, when he's no longer with us, but my father, when he was 80, he asked me to look at his butterfly.
Yeah.
And my answer was, Dad, the fact you're doing butterfly at 80, you should be really grateful that you stayed on with it.
Wow. Yeah. So if you're still doing stuff over 60, congratulations on your motivation, enthusiasm. The advice I've picked up echoes what Graham said. Probably there's less need to do long, slow distance stuff, although you intuitively might think it's a lot better for you to go easier and longer when you get older. That sort of goes against the grain in terms of what you're losing. You're losing power and explosiveness. So I would, if my training prescription for older athletes would be, lift more weights, keep your body mobile in the face of aging and, you know, tendons and ligaments tending to tighten up. Maybe don't do as much volume, keep up the intensity and don't be afraid of doing hard stuff, but be careful of or be aware of the fact that you probably need to take more recovery. So, you know, like Graham mentioned that protocol earlier where you might do, instead of doing 21-minute efforts, do five, take a rest, do five more, take a rest, do five more. And instead of the 60 seconds between them, take 75. So do what you can, maintain the quality. Have a dog, because that can keep you company. I would also echo what Graham said about consistency is important. So if you get ill or injured, you'll lose fitness quicker and it'll take you longer to get it back. So you'll constantly feel like you're fighting to go upstream. So the important thing is to really listen to your body and be able to manage your training load. Now, Ned Overend, who you might remember, Graham, he was a mountain bike guy and then went into Xterra and those off-road triathlons. I think he said, I can still do the same training load that I used to do when I was 30, but it just takes me 4 weeks to get it done now instead of 2 weeks. Right. Yeah. So, you know, you can still train hard when you're older. You just need more recovery. So yeah, be mindful of that. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Next, Ian Smith says, how can I make triathlon cheaper? Whoa, I'd like to know that answer to that one.
Well, I don't think we can make it cheaper as far as the cost of entering, but certainly on the equipment front.
Yeah.
There's so many, shopping places on the internet now where you can buy secondhand gear, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's probably pretty good.
Well, and I was chatting to a friend who's going off to do Ironman Arizona. And he said, I'm riding on my road bike this time, Simon, because I want the enjoyment of doing the ride with my head up a little bit. I'm not so bothered about an expensive time trial bike. We don't have to be seduced by the marketeers to buy the best and most expensive of everything that's out there. The majority of kit that you said, whether it's secondhand or whether it's the introductory model, is probably far better than the bikes you and I had 20 years ago when we first started, Graham. Yeah. And it was... And you look at the bikes that Dave Scott won the Ironman on back in 1989, or no, he didn't win it in 1989, did he? But the years before that, 1987, and what Mark Allen was riding in 1989, they would be like a £500 entry bike now compared to some of the, like the Cervelo P5X. So there's nothing wrong with those bikes. They will get you round. A triathlon, and there are some smaller, cheaper events. The bigger events are going to charge more money. So do local events. Do a little triathlon with your mates. You don't have to go and do an organized race.
Yeah.
Do your own. Go to the pool one morning, cycle somewhere, and then run back and do your own little triathlon. There's an awful lot of ways, but one of them is not to be investing in the latest gadgets.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay, Paddy Coyle said, what's the best thing to avoid when starting into triathlon training?
Ooh, that's...
It depends.
Yeah, it depends. Are there triathletes for a start? No, I don't know. The best thing to avoid when starting into triathlon training? Going back to what you just said, avoid getting sucked into the feeling that you need to have all the best equipment under the sun to be able to do it when you don't.
I'd extend that and just avoid gadgetry to start with. You don't need that precision when you're just starting out. If you swim, bike and run regularly and you get the basics right, you'll improve. And actually, you can get to a really high level just doing that and listening to your body.
Yeah, and probably conversely, avoid inconsistency, because we know that will then lead to consistency.
Yeah. Okay. Right, Graham. So you wanted to cover these first, but I thought it would be a good point to finish on. At what distance triathlon do you think a structured training plan or coach is necessary?
I guess it would specifically be related to what's the objective of doing, what do you want to get out of doing triathlon?
Yeah, so it's not related necessarily to the distance you're doing, rather what you want to get out of it as a triathlete.
Yeah, and what level you want to compete at. Are you looking to podium in your age group at a world championship level, or are you looking to just complete them? Because it's like anything, you can probably get there if you've got enough time, and and we've had these conversations, haven't we? When people say, "Yeah, I just want to finish," and it starts off like that, and then at some point they come up with that miraculously, they come up with, I thought 12 hours would be a good target.
That's for an Ironman, not a standard distance triathlon, by the way.
Exactly, for an Ironman, and it's sort of, well, where does that come from?
Yeah.
So again, it would probably depend on the type of person that they are, whether they, there's some people that just can't follow training plans or coaching doesn't work, or, it's very individual, isn't it? I think the answer to that.
Well, let's take you and me then, Graham. You and I have been in triathlon long enough, so we've got a fairly good idea of what works for us and what doesn't. Yeah. We've got a fairly good understanding of physiology, and we've got a fairly good understanding of the requirements of different distances of triathlon. So in terms of, and we both know our daily and weekly schedules. So putting together a training plan wouldn't be difficult for us. What we might perhaps value more with that understanding is having somebody who acted more as a coach, who was to challenge us and say, okay, Graham, so you've got an awful lot of biking in there at this here on Zwift, for instance. There's no outdoor riding. What was it that prompted you to choose that approach? Okay, there's not much running in here. Why would that be? Can you explain why, you know, what was your justification for choosing this approach in your swimming? So somebody who gets you to think inwardly and reflect on, well, why did I choose that? Well, that's what I've always done. Okay, well, do you think using the approach that you've always done is one that's going to work? So you can get different sorts of coaches. I would suggest that novice athletes might need more guidance on structure and somebody just showing them on what to do when and how to do, and more experienced athletes might be able to prepare their own program but require more of a sounding board and a mentor to challenge them and sort of hold them accountable.
So it depends on their own athletic background and where they've come from, isn't it? You know, so they might have been like a self-coach runner, and it'd be quite easy once they know what types of sessions to do on swim and the bike. They're quite happy to write their own program.
Yeah, so Sabrina, I'm awfully sorry to. Well, I think we've given you some good advice, and I'm awfully sorry to finish off with on that one with what Graham has said, and we've used many times. It's the coach's favourite phrase, and the athlete's most frustrating response is "It depends." We ought to write a book called "It Depends," Graham.
Yes.
Has anyone done that yet? Do you think?
No.
It depends.
Yeah.
Right, one last question then from another Graham, spelt slightly differently. Graham Miles said, what is the biggest change in thinking you've had in coaching? So over to you, Graham.
I would say, certainly from a coaching background, was the validity of doing threshold training.
Wow. What was it that prompted you? Here's me as a coach or a mentor then at challenging you now and saying, what was it that prompted you to come to that realization?
Well, being a swimmer, I was sort of like the bread and butter of most swimming training was based around like threshold training. And then when I did my level four coaching, there was the guy that used to be the sports scientist behind Luc Van Laerde in the 90s. A guy called Jan Olbrek.
Yep.
And he was like the guru for lactate testing in the 90s. And he just happened to be on the coaching course I was doing, but doing a presentation on lactate testing. And he showed how there was no need really to do threshold training. So the old adage that threshold training would elicit better endurance, etc. He said, well, you can do that by training at a lower intensity. And then if you actually speak to a lot of the sports scientists and you say, where is the evidence, the scientific evidence that states that threshold training actually brings about this type of response and improvement? And there isn't a lot of it about, whereas the, you know, more of the polarized above threshold and below threshold, like a lot of the Phil Maffetone ideology of training at that intensity is what you need to do. So at that point, and this is going back to the year 2000, certainly with myself and a lot of the swimming coaching that I was doing at the time, I took out that intensity completely out of the program.
How did that work out then in terms of response?
Well, fantastic, because certainly in swimming terms, you're swimming at a lower intensity so you can be more efficient. So you've got less tired athletes becoming less ill and less injured, but they're doing more swimming at an intensity where they will be practicing a more efficient movement pattern. So I just thought, well, it's a win-win all round. Because all that threshold training was doing, certainly in the swimming pool with teenagers, is they're just getting very tired and end up swimming very badly.
Yeah, and that's threshold, I think, is what Maffetone and Brad Cairns, if you listen to the Primal Blueprint podcast, they talk about kind of hard. And as triathletes, we know, because we've done it and we've seen other people, they never really go that easy pace that you talk about, regardless of the discipline. And and actually, if you put them in a pool with swimmers that were sprinters and said, right, 25 meters hard as you can, like your life depends on it, most people never actually really trained that hard. And if they did, they'd understand the value of taking longer recoveries. Yeah. It's a point of frustration for me that we're in the pool and, you know, we're doing 50s off 90 seconds and there's people there going, well, I've got my breath back now, so let's do them off 75 because, you know, then we can squeeze a few more in. And I'm like, that's not the reason why we do them off a long recovery. We do them because we want to keep the efficiency and the quality up. Great. That's a great reflection as a coach. And so I've probably had a similar reflection to you on that one. So rather than duplicate yours, I would go back to the sort of thing that you hinted at the beginning, is that in recent years, I have become much more engaged in the holistic aspect of coaching. I see myself more as a life coach for triathletes than a triathlon coach now. And what's behind that was the realization that the obstacles that were preventing those athletes from reaching their goals weren't the willingness to train or train hard and not the type of training they were doing. They were the life obstacles. So you do 12 or 15 hours of training a week, but you're not getting enough sleep to get the maximum value from that training. Or you are getting the right sleep, but your nutrition is poor. And so you're eating food that may be actually working in the opposite direction, so preventing you from getting fitter. You know, you eat too many carbohydrates and too much refined sugar, and that creates inflammation in the muscles, which can lead to breakdown, not recovery. Or maybe that your life is just too full of stress. You're on the go all the time and you need a bit of space. And so it was those things that I wanted to try and help people to put right. And lo and behold, if we reduced the training a little, but lifted the amount of time they were spending working on those other elements, all of a sudden they started improving. And that was a huge revelation to me. And so now my concentration is far more focused on those life aspects, really. That doesn't mean training has less value. It just means that other things have, I've elevated the value of those so they have equal value and have equal focus from the athletes. And it's about that. You mentioned it briefly. It's about creating the right foundation of health to create longevity, to improve performance. And once you've got that foundation, then, you know, it's easy to build good fitness on top of it.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. And I would agree with everything you've said.
Wow. We're done, Graham. We've been on for a while. I think the listeners have got some fantastic value today. So listen, mate, thanks very much. It's been great catching up. Your input, as always, has been valued. I appreciate you taking the time out of your day. The dog clearly wants your attention now. Is it time to go for a walk?
It is time to go for a walk, yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, listeners, look, that was Graham Brookhouse. Hope you've enjoyed him joining me to answer some of your reader and listener questions. We will do this again, Graham, because it's been good. I think we've given a lot of information and value out there. If you want to continue these conversations, please feel free to post below this where you see it on your Facebook page. But from Graham and myself, thanks for listening and goodbye, and see you again next time.
Goodbye.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.